Welcome to the Shortwave Report for December 16, 2011. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's www.outfarpress.com. You can find the schedule for dozens of international broadcasters in English. There you can also listen to the past four shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, Spanish National Radio, Radio Havana Cuba, The Voice of Russia, and NHK World Radio Japan. We'll begin with Deutsche Welle. The United Nations Climate Change Conference ended with only a roadmap for further talks, which has drawn criticism from scientists and environmentalists, including Greenpeace. Canada announced that it is formally withdrawing from the Kyoto Protocol, which France and Japan called bad news for efforts to slow down climate change. Labor unions in Italy are staging a week of strikes over austerity measures. European Union ministers approved a deal with the United States to keep airline passengers' personal data for 15 years. The euro currency fell to an 11-month low against the U.S. dollar. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
The roadmap for further talks decided at the UN Climate Summit in Durban on Sunday continues to draw criticism from environmentalists and scientists who say it's too timid to effectively slow down global warming. Greenpeace says waiting for a pact in 2015, intended to bind all major polluters, could still spell disastrous warming. Its director, Kumi Naidu, said the United States had inserted a get-out clause in Durban and might still exploit it. In Germany, leading climate researcher Hans-Joachim Schnellhuber said a deal by 2015 left hardly any time because rising atmospheric carbon levels could exceed a tipping point in 2020.
Science has shown time and time again that emissions must start dropping by 2020 at the latest. 2015 would be better. Once again, we're putting off what needs to be done.
Sunday's Durban Compromise extends the 1997 Kyoto Protocol, which was not binding on China, the United States, and India until the next pact is reached.
Canada has announced that it will formally be withdrawing from the Kyoto Protocol on climate change, the world's first country to pull out of the global treaty. Its Environment Minister, Peter Kent, made the announcement on national television on Monday. To not leave Kyoto would harm Canada's economy, he said. Canada says that it backs a new global deal to cut emissions of greenhouse gases, but insists that it has to cover all nations, including China and India, which currently are not bound by Kyoto's current targets. The protocol aims to fight global warming by reducing worldwide greenhouse emissions. France has called Canada's decision on Monday to withdraw from the Kyoto Protocol bad news for global efforts to fight climate change. On Tuesday, Japan weighed in on the issue, calling Canada's decision regrettable. Meanwhile, the UN's climate chief said that she still says that Canada has legal obligations to cut its CO2 emissions. Before pulling out of Kyoto, Canada long complained that the pact was unworkable since it excluded the world's two biggest emitters, those being the U.S. and China. Labor unions in Italy have begun a week of strikes to protest the government's tough austerity package. Metal workers, including those at the carmaker Fiat, walked out for a full 8 hours on Monday, while printing press operators shut down their productions of most newspapers. Despite resistance from Germany and Austria, European Union ministers have approved a deal with the United States to allow U.S. authorities to keep airline passengers' personal data for 15 years. The deal, which still has to be approved by the European Parliament, gives U.S. agencies the right to sift through data for terror-related investigations. Some of the data involved includes name, home address, and credit card information. And finally, the euro currency fell to an 11-month low against the U.S. dollar on Tuesday as worries about Europe's debt crisis continue. Worries about a possible credit downgrade for Europe's economic motors, Germany and France, sent the currency to as low as 130 against the dollar. The eurozone agreed to impose stricter budget discipline on members last week, but markets were not convinced that it had done enough to solve its two-year-old debt crisis.
Those reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website called mediacenter.dw-world.de. On to Spanish National Radio. The head of the European Commission accused the UK of risking the integrity of Europe's single market when Prime Minister Cameron vetoed the new fiscal treaty. A commentary on how a taboo was destroyed when former Greek Prime Minister Papandreou proposed a referendum on leaving the EU. Spanish National Radio.
The head of the European Commission has accused the United Kingdom of risking the integrity of Europe's single market. Speaking at the European Parliament in Strasbourg, José Manuel Durão Barroso gave his account of last weekend's Euro Summit in Brussels, when the UK was the only country of the 27-member European Union that refused to agree treaty changes and vetoed the new fiscal pact in order to protect its financial service industry.
United Kingdom, in exchange for giving its agreement, asked for a specific protocol on financial services, which, as presented, was a risk to the integrity of the internal market. This made compromise impossible.
The fiscal compact, as it's known, is designed to allow closer monitoring of countries' spending in order to prevent a repeat of the eurozone's current debt crisis. Earlier, the president of the European Council, Herman Van Rompuy, said he hoped to see the new fiscal deal signed by most EU states by early March. It was 22 years ago, just after the fall of the Berlin Wall, that the German poet and essayist Hans Magnus Enzensberger first put forward his thesis that the truly great politicians of the late 20th century were like generals of armies who were retreating, those who could lead their people from the jaws of defeat without too much bloodshed. At the end of the 1980s, the German writer's heroes were not Ronald Reagan or Margaret Thatcher, but Mikhail Gorbachev, who oversaw the breakdown of the Soviet Union without revolution, General Jaruzelski of Poland, who, despite the military hardware at his disposal, allowed his country to drift in the wake of the Solidarity movement towards democracy without tanks on the streets, and Adolfo Suarez, the man who led Spain from dictatorship to democracy, avoiding the pitfalls of a second civil war. Unlike Reagan and Thatcher, who attacked and destroyed obstacles in their way, in the way of free market neoliberalism, that is, and were admired for their daring advances against the nanny state, the three retreating politicians suffered the opprobrium of their own people and were cast out of office for rolling back the frontiers of dictatorship and autarky. But where are the heroes in retreat in today's Europe of economic crisis? There are many losers, that's for sure. Italy's Silvio Berlusconi and the prime ministers of Ireland and Portugal, whose names I care not to remember, come to mind immediately. In this category, you might think George Papandreou of Greece should be included too. He was kicked out ignominiously by the all-powerful troika of European Central Bank, European Commission, and the International Monetary Fund, who then imposed a technocratic government on Athens to visit yet more economic pain on the long-suffering Greek population. But think again. There are grounds for viewing Papandreou in a different light. For decades now, Europe's leaders have refused to confront what is truth that anyone but a newborn baby can see. That the Europe we have built, call it the European Union, or limit it to the Eurozone, if you will, is based on serious economic and social imbalances. What Papandreou has helped change in the throes of the biggest financial crisis since the Wall Street crash of 1929 is that suddenly there are people thinking the unthinkable. The first of these unthinkable thoughts is the idea that Europe should break up. We were supposed to be united forever and ever, amen. J. George Papandreou snapped European leaders out of their certainty that a Europe of the many, of ever closer union, of deeper and wider commitment, was the only way forward for our continent. When he suggested a referendum in Greece so that the Greeks themselves could decide whether to carry on supporting more Europain or get out of the union altogether and go it alone, alarm bells went off in Brussels, Berlin and Paris, that a taboo was being destroyed. Papandreou was removed from office by Brussels, but not before he had changed the mindset of Europe's leaders. Suddenly, we were all allowed to think that the number of nations within Europe is a variable feast, that the number could go down as well as up. Europe is not just a one-way street to membership. Some nations may still want to jump aboard, but others, who believe they are being driven in a handcart to hell, may want to get off before being totally consumed by the flames. I'm not thinking about Britain here either. The UK has always been an exception to membership of the club, with its opt-outs and escape clauses, and its Eurosceptics who believe that an island nation is better left like it is, detached from the rest of the continent. No, it was the fact that it was the leader of a poor, small, southern European country who threatened to call a plebiscite on continued membership of the European Union that proved explosive. Some thought poor Papandreou had lost his marbles, not those that Lord Elgin took to London, but his mental attributes. But look at it this way. It is only a month since Papandreou mooted the unmootable, yet people are now weighing up the consequences of countries leaving the Union. Other taboos are also beginning to be questioned. For example, the German credo that the European Central Bank should never be lender of last resort for the member states, nor should it buy government bonds, nor print enough money to flood the markets with liquidity. If any of these taboos are finally destroyed, helping us out of the current mess we're in, saving us from ever more grinding austerity, and allowing us to recover some of our democratic rights, such as voting for those we want to govern us, we will have a lot to thank George Papandreou for.
That report and commentary were from Spanish National Radio, now heard from 4 to 5 p.m. at 5970, and podcasting at www.rtve.es. All the times I'm announcing are for Pacific Standard Time, so adjust them to your time zone. Next, Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba joined in the criticism of the UN Climate Change Summit. Military clashes have continued in Libya between rival groups of the former rebel armies. A 20-year-old Palestinian protester was killed by an Israeli soldier who shot him in the face with a tear gas canister. The Cuban ambassador to France spoke about the significance of the creation of the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, or CELAC. Radio Havana, Cuba.
The United Nations Climate Change Conference in Durban, South Africa, has ended with an agreement for nations to start negotiations for a new legally binding climate treaty that would not come into force until 2020. While the conference extended the duration of the Kyoto Protocol for a second term, there were only promises of emission reduction and no real commitment for industrialized nations. Many environmental groups said that the agreement does not do enough to deal with the climate crisis, and the Atkins Executive Director of Friends of the Earth said, "This empty shell of a plan leaves the planet hurtling towards catastrophic climate change." Cuba urged developed countries to amend Annex B to the protocol to prevent a gap between the first and second commitment periods, with a view towards full ratification. The Deputy Minister of Science, Technology and Environment of Cuba, Fernando González, said that developed countries, with their irresponsible attitude, are condemning the poorest 40% of the global population to a future with very little chance of survival and development. The Cuban representative at the Durban conference said that the rich nations use political and economic blackmail would like for us to forget that 76% of the cumulative emissions in the atmosphere and which now causes climate change originate within its borders, which has only 20% of the world's population. A tense calm prevailed on Monday in the Libyan capital of Tripoli after clashes at the international airport between former rebels of the Libyan National Army and the Sintan brigades. At least 4 were reported killed in the fighting. Local sources believe that the fighting among rival groups close to the National Transitional Council, NTC, is a struggle for power after the NATO-backed war against Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. A Libyan television channel confirmed that former rebel forces in Tripoli approached a checkpoint near the airport on Sunday in an attempt to take control of the facility. In recent days, Libyan military rulers have given rebel militias a deadline of December 20th to hand over their weapons and leave Tripoli. A 20-year-old Palestinian protester was killed over the weekend when an Israeli soldier apparently shot him in the face with a tear gas canister. Mustafa Tamimi was taking part in a weekly protest against the encroachment of a nearby Israeli settlement in the occupied West Bank. In related news, Israel is moving ahead with plans to build 40 single-family houses near the illegal West Bank settlements of Ifra. At a lecture at the Foreign Press Center in France, Cuban Ambassador to France Orlando Requiejo stated Monday that the creation of the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, CELAC, is an event of great significance responding to aspirations for unity. Ambassadors, representatives of Latin American and Caribbean countries, and members of organizations promoting solidarity with Cuba were in attendance. According to Havana's ambassador to Paris, the creation of CELAC fulfills Simón Bolívar's dream of a single nation from Mexico to the Patagonia, as well as the ideas of José Martí and others who have fought for Latin America's independence. Founded in Caracas earlier this month, the organization is made up of 33 states, which together make up more than 580 million people.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba, heard from 2 to 3 p.m. at 11760 and from 4 to 11 p.m. at either 6060, 6010, or 6000. Also streaming on the web from 4 to 11 p.m. at www.radiohc.cu. On to the voice of Russia. Russia has seen many large demonstrations following recent election controversies. The United States has supported the Russian government's nonviolent response to the people in the streets. Hillary Clinton questioned whether the elections were free and fair, angering Prime Minister Putin and bringing up the influence that the U.S. has in elections around the world. The voice of Russia.
The Russian government may have given a lukewarm response to last Saturday's protests in Moscow, but the Obama administration celebrated the peaceful demonstrations as a sign of democracy. White House spokesman Jay Carney described the demonstration as a very positive sign to all those who support the democratic process. He was quoted by agency France Presse as saying during a press conference, "The Russian governmental authorities have allowed the demonstrations to take place and refrained from interfering. Russian demonstrators abided by the law and held peaceful meetings."
Carney further added that the government and leaders of Russian society seem to be looking for a dialogue, saying, "We are encouraged by President Medvedev's commitment to have the Central Election Commission investigate all election violations, and we welcome what appears to be a new era of tolerance for the freedom of assembly."
Up to 50,000 people gathered on Bolotnaya Square near the Kremlin on Saturday to protest against the alleged fraud at the December 4th parliamentary elections, in which Prime Minister Vladimir Putin's ruling United Russia Party lost about 14% of the vote compared to 2007 elections, as well as its supermajority in the Duma.
The demonstrators contested the results of the elections amid allegations of ballot stuffing and reports of irregularities by election monitoring organizations. The protesters demand the annulment of the election results and Vladimir Churov, the Central Election Committee chairman, to resign from his post. In a response to statements made by U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, in which she questioned the legitimacy of last week's parliamentary elections in Russia, Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin accused her of interfering in Russian politics. 2 days after the election, Clinton spoke at a meeting of foreign ministers when she claimed that Russia's elections were neither free nor fair.
Putin, who's planning to run for president in the upcoming presidential elections in March, accused the U.S. Secretary of State of attempting to send a signal to Russia's opposition, referring to the opposition protests which were organized following the elections. The Prime Minister said of the demonstrators, they heard this signal and started active work with the support of the U.S. Department of State. Putin also reacted sharply to remarks made by State Department spokesman Mark Toner, in which he said that the U.S. spends $9 million annually to help fund Russia's NGOs. The Russian Prime Minister said, it's unacceptable when financing is being provided to some domestic organizations that are believed to be national but in fact work for foreign money and perform under the music of a foreign country. Putin added, we need to protect ourselves from this intervention in our internal affairs and protect our sovereignty, which is in the interest of the entire Russian society.
The Prime Minister explained the reasons why foreign countries choose to support the opposition in Russia, saying, Russia remains a large nuclear power, which causes some concern among our partners. They try to rock us, so we will not forget who the owner of the planet is and obey this owner. They want us to feel that they have leverage in our country. It should make us think when foreign money is invested in political activities in our country. Particularly unacceptable is an infusion of foreign money in the electoral process. This is simply unacceptable.
Friday morning, the Russian news website Life News published correspondence between the Independent Elections Monitoring Organization GOLIS and the U.S. government's Agency for International Development, USAID. According to that correspondence, not only does the U.S. budget pay for practically every piece of information concerning elections violations in Russia, it encourages activists to complain to the authorities about these violations. USAID also demands detailed financial reports, apparently not trusting Russian activists.
InFocus spoke about USAID to Russian NGOs with Vyacheslav Nikonov, president of the Policy Foundation in Moscow.
Putin's words about possible American interference in the Russian domestic affairs are not groundless, because it is well known, it's official, that the State Department, that the USAID, they are funding the Russian opposition. Of course, that is the money officially is used to support the Russian democracy or pro-democracy forces, but for some reason there is a complete coincidence between the pro-democracy forces and the opposition forces, and those forces which are leading the marches of those who are dissatisfied with Putin's policies or dissatisfied with the results of the elections. So it's clear, it's evident, and I don't think it's something new. The United States is influencing the election outcomes in many countries in the world, and this is clear, this is official. So what Putin said is just the fact.
Those reports were from the Voice of Russia. Russia is now heard from 6 p.m. to 10 at 12030 13665 9840 and 7250, or through their website www.english.ruvr.ru. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or would like to make a donation for production costs of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. I am grateful for any donations to help support this program. We will conclude with NHK World Radio Japan. As the Japanese fleet gets ready to go whale hunting in the Antarctic region, the Sea Shepherd prepares to interfere. The Japanese government and TEPCO have announced that it will take up to 40 years to decommission the Fukushima damaged nuclear reactors. NHK Japan.
Four countries, including the United States and Australia, are urging anti-whaling activists and Japanese whalers to avoid a repeat of past violent clashes in the Antarctic Ocean. The joint statement on Wednesday by the US, Australia, New Zealand and the Netherlands warns of possible injuries and death if the clashes are repeated. Their statement comes ahead of the Japanese fleet's research whaling season, which could start before the year end. The four governments urge that both sides act responsibly and make the safety of human life at sea their highest priority. They warn that any incident jeopardizes not only the safety of the vessels and crew, but also anyone who comes to their rescue. The statement reiterates the four countries' opposition to research whaling and says they are disappointed by the Japanese fleet's departure for Antarctic waters. The US-based Sea Shepherd Conservation Society is dispatching three boats from Australia, aiming to obstruct the Japanese whaling fleet again this year. Sea Shepherd has harassed the Japanese fleet in the past by throwing smoke canisters at the vessels. Earlier this month, Japan's Institute of Cetacean Research, which conducts research whaling and a vessel owner, filed suit in the United States against Sea Shepherd to stop its obstructive action. Japan's Fisheries Agency says research whaling is approved by international treaty and interference by Sea Shepherd will not be tolerated.
Japan's government and the operator of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant say it will take up to 40 years to decommission the plant's damaged reactors. NHK has learned about a timetable drawn up by the Industry Ministry and Tokyo Electric Power Company based on a report released earlier by the state's Atomic Energy Commission. The new timetable includes a plan to begin removing used fuel rods from spent fuel pools at four reactor buildings within 2 years, starting with Reactor 4. That's 1 year ahead of what the Commission called for in its report. The removed spent fuel will be temporarily stored within the compound. The timetable also says that work to remove the melted fuel inside the number 1 through number 3 reactors should be completed in 25 years, when dismantling the reactors and buildings will begin. The Ministry and TEPCO aim to completely scrap the entire compound within 40 years. The schedule includes repair work to fill cracks in the reactors and containment vessels where the contaminated water has leaked. The unprecedented work involves very difficult working conditions, including high levels of radiation and the use of remote-controlled robots. The government plans to declare on Friday that the second phase of its timetable to bring the Fukushima plant under control has been achieved, with all the reactors brought to a state of cold shutdown. It also plans to release the new timetable to dismantle the reactors later this month.
The new timetable says that work to decommission the damaged reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant will be completed in three phases. Used fuel rods will be removed from spent pools during the first phase from April 2012 to March 2015. Surveys will try to identify the source of contaminated water leaks from reactor containment vessels. In the second phase, from 2015 through 2021, containment vessels will be repaired and filled with water to block intense radiation from the melted fuel. An underwater camera will be sent into the reactors to locate the melted fuel and determine its condition. Filling reactors with water is considered the most difficult challenge in this phase, as there is no precedent for the work during the dismantling of the damaged Three Mile Island nuclear plant in the United States. In the third phase from 2022, engineers will begin retrieving the melted fuel from reactors and containment vessels using robots. This will be a difficult, precise operation in small, confined spaces with high levels of radiation.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan, heard from 9 to 9:30 p.m. at 6110 or on the web at www.nhk.or.jp. All the times I've announced are for Pacific Standard Time. Please adjust them to your time zone. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage you to listen to international broadcasts using a shortwave radio at home, which is simpler than you might think. However, if you use the internet, listening globally is also quite easy. See the links at this program's website. Every Friday morning, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find internet links for international broadcasters, make a safe donation through PayPal, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report is free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.